From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made on May 9th, 2006. New York Governor George Pataki visited Orleans County to see the site of a proposed corn-based ethanol plant. Pataki boasted that we were looking at an alternative energy future with corn-based ethanol, and taxpayers should be proud to help support it. Pataki said that 6 million bushels of corn would be purchased from growers across western New York each year, with another 13 million bushels coming from other states. You know, like Iowa, which just happens to be home of the first presidential contest and a big farm lobby. Congressman Tom Reynolds helped secure a $25 million taxpayer-backed loan package for the new corn-based ethanol plant. It was going to produce 50 million gallons of ethanol annually. Corn had to be better than oil, right? Well, it didn't take long for analysts on all sides to wonder, should we put all of our chips on corn-based ethanol, or what really is the energy future for this country? And frankly, analysts on all sides of the political spectrum have come to regret some of what we did with corn-based ethanol. Here's an example, writing for Mother Jones. Kevin Drum declared, quote, corn ethanol, it turns out, is catastrophically idiotic. It's actually worse for the environment than even gasoline. Now look, we're not all that cynical about corn-based ethanol, and I think it's important to add to the discussion where it stands and what its place is. But what will replace it? What is the broad future? What about switchgrass, algae, sorghum, and more? Today, we know solar's on the move. Wind energy retains a foothold. But what is the future of biofuels? Our monthly science roundtable is going to tackle that for us this hour. And let me welcome the panel. From the University of Rochester's Department of Chemical Engineering, David Wu is here. David, thank you for being here. Shaw Chen is here as well. Shaw, thank you for being here. And Alex Shestopolov is here. Alex, thank you. And also here, Jack Barron, the President and Chief Operating Officer of Sweetwater Energy. That's a company based in Rochester that aims to produce a renewable alternative to petroleum. Jack, thank you for being here.
A pleasure.
I'm going to start with one simple question. I'm going to start with Jack. When we talk about the alternative energy future, you know, Governor Pataki 9 years ago talked jobs, et cetera, but I think the broader question has to be, how does it relate to climate change and how does it relate to a long-term, and I'm not talking 5, 10 years, how does it relate to a long-term move away from petroleum? What's Sweetwater's role in that?
Sure. Well, we make sugar, and we make that from a variety of waste biomass. Such waste wood actually is probably our favorite right now. We also can make it from switchgrass, and I guess the question in most people's minds would be, is this the kind of sugar you have on your table? And it's not. It really looks a lot like kind of a dark brown maple syrup, and it's about as fluid as a dark brown maple syrup. But from that, you can actually take the carbon from that sugar and make virtually every product that you can make from petroleum eventually. Now, near term, meaning the next few years, you can probably make a good dozen solid products that you could make from petroleum. But your question was a great one, Evan, in terms of how does this impact climate change? Well, with petroleum, we're still pulling up 400 million year old oil, which was organic matter from plants or animals, you know, 400 million years ago. And we're adding the carbon from that to the atmosphere and brand new, which is really the cause essentially of global warming or the primary driver. With something like this cellulosic sugar, or even with corn ethanol for that matter, you're taking last year's carbon, so carbon that's currently in the atmosphere that gets stored in trees or in grasses, and you're reprocessing that. So you're not adding new carbon to the atmosphere. And the fact that we can actually make plastics and a lot of the chemicals that we use every day in our homes and paints and urethanes and even nylons in our clothing and the plastics in our cell phone, et cetera, can actually come from current carbon instead of coming from 400 million-year-old carbon, that's a big deal.
And Jack, I think to some degree, I brought up the corn-based ethanol plant because it's a reminder, 9, 10 years feels like a lot. Time passes quickly. Sometimes the media wants to latch onto an idea and say, all right, switchgrass, when can you make it scalable? 2 years? 3 years? Algae, when can we make? And I think to some degree, we do need to offer a realistic view of timelines, right?
Sure, agreed. DuPont and other companies, a company called Poet out in the Midwest, and Abengoa, who are based in Spain but have a plant in Kansas, they're commercial now, making cellulosic ethanol, roughly 20 to 25 million gallons per facility that they're creating right now. But there are companies like Genomatica out on the West Coast and Solazyme and others that are making a lot of products from sugar directly. And even Dasani water bottles right now, which are Dasani's owned by Coca-Cola, they are using a bioplastic, which is coming from sugar, directly. And the plastic itself for the water bottle is actually being made by a company called NatureWorks for Coca-Cola. And then Odwalla, which some people drink. I don't want to give anybody any plugs because I don't own stock in any of those companies. But Odwalla makes their plastic bottles 100% from sugar today. So really, that's the focus of Sweetwater. It's beyond fuel. Fuel, we believe, is going to be part of our equation long term, but we're very excited about bioplastics, biochemicals, industrial biochemicals, the kind that go into products that we as consumers use every day.
Well, let me ask Professor Wu regarding climate change. That has to be part of this conversation now. And when I look at our consumption of oil and petroleum, you know, there's varying estimates on when it may run out, for lack of a better word. And I know that's sort of a fungible term in terms of when it may run out, for lack of a better word. But if I could, I want to read a comment about running out of oil and get your take on it, especially as it relates to climate change. Writing for economics.com, Mike Moffitt says, we're looking at it the wrong way. He says, we're failing to consider that we always devise new and better ways to extract more and more oil. His headline declares, we will never run out of oil. But then he acknowledges that we will greatly see diminished availability, which will push consumers to find alternatives to oil and gas. He writes, Economics 101 tells us we will have a series of price increases and a series of reductions in the total amount of gasoline consumed. Eventually, the price will reach a point where gasoline will become a niche good purchased by very few consumers, while other consumers will have found alternatives to gas. And so he says, don't let the government move the market. That's when the transportation companies will move the market as necessary. What do you think about that, especially in terms of the urgency when it comes to climate change?
No, I think that before we hit the oil depletion or the peak point, I think we may already facing extreme climate change, and that is a result of burning unlimited gasoline and emitting carbon dioxide into the air. And the problem is worsened because, for example, United States used to be the only country that is burning a lot of gasoline. But now China is catching up and India is catching up. So we're adding so much burden to the earth and to the atmosphere by getting like triple the amount of carbon dioxide that United States used to emit into the air. So we have other growing developing country like Brazil, and then everybody started to use gasoline. So we can see that this problem is going to be more serious and just worrying about depletion
serious
of the gasoline.
Now,
serious now. And so I think that if we wait until the point of return to address this issue, it will be too late. So developing alternative green energy, such as bioenergy, we had to really take it seriously.
We have some interesting comments and questions coming in already online, and I'm going to get to those coming up here with our panel. If you want to call the program as we talk about biofuels and the future of energy, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. So let's look at the landscape of what is out there now. We've already started to do that, but I remember even 10 years ago a friend saying, bet on algae. Take a look at algae. And of course, for those of us not in the field, we think of algae in the way that we encounter it somewhat normally, which is occasionally when we are in contact with water. And it's not all that pleasant. It's hard to sort of envision how it works. But then you get headlines out of Alabama, for example, where they are starting to get much more serious about what they're doing with algae. Alabama got the first in the world carbon negative algae biofuel, according to Tina Casey from Clean Technica Online. So they're serious about it. I have no idea what photobioreactors are or how they work, but Shaw Chen, I'll start with you. Algae, is it a viable future?
Okay, I will start with Jack's comment early on, and that is very valid. When we talk about biomass conversion today, we are not only talking about bioenergy, but also chemical feedstock. And I guess that today's subject is about bioenergy, so that's where I'm going to focus on. In terms of, in the general area of bioenergy, they are generally considered three generations. One is corn bioethanol, the second is lignocellulose, and the third generation, which is the least developed today, that is microalgae or algae. And why algae? Algae has some distinct advantages. That is, there is a variety of species that can be grown under different conditions. And photobioreactor is designed to grow the desired species to meet the regional needs.
So tell me if I'm understanding this right, Professor. I was trying to understand how the term photobioreactor works, and the best I can tell, it's a little bit like taking a plastic bag, filling it with, you know, wastewater, for example, throw in some algae, and then letting sunlight grow it?
Right.
Is that correct?
Right. And there is more to it because it has to do with the species. And depending on the species of interest, the design of the photobioreactor. Photobioreactor simply means it's a biochemical reactor initiated and conducted under light. All right. So that's the design principle. But let me also get back to the general idea of algae. Mm-hmm. Algae offers a wide range of species, and algae can be used to develop different materials. For example, diesel, bioethanol included, and also a variety of chemicals. So it's a very versatile bioresource today. And at the same time, the growth rate, we talk about the growth of species, the growth rate is overnight. The harvesting and the productivity of energy and chemicals can be 10 times as much as celestial products such as trees. I am not so sure about switchgrass. Switchgrass is designed to grow very fast, so that the rate of the growth to maturity, I have to count on Jack's expertise. And I want to go back to the climate change also. In general, the utilization of fossil fuels, which include petroleum, natural gas, and more traditionally coal, generates a lot of carbons. And annually, based on the data 2 years ago, the total generation of carbon is in excess of tens of billion metric tons globally, and the number is going up. And we are behind China overall, but the per capita expense to the atmosphere, we are still way above number one over there. So that's something I agree with David, that we should try to develop alternatives to suppress the carbon emission. So that's the point I want to add. And there's a recent surge in shale gas,
yes.
I have to comment on that too. Mm-hmm. Indeed, natural gas, primarily methane, emits half of the greenhouse into the atmosphere compared to coal, especially compared to petroleum overall. But the production of methane suffers from several additional environmental problems. Number one, the inevitable leakage of methane into the environment has nothing to do with the combustion of methane as an energy source. Methane itself is about 1,000 times more potent as greenhouse effect compared to carbon dioxide. And there is other environmental concerns in the general area where shale gas is being fracked. So that's a major concern. Fortunately, the New York State has voted down on the proposal to allow
right.
natural allow fracking in general.
Okay, and so what you just touched on, Professor Chen, is that there are unfortunately consequences. There's no perfect energy source for it. We know that. We know that when they started moving to corn-based ethanol, farmers were, typically farmers will rotate crops. And they were not rotating crops, that we saw food prices impacted by that. There were a lot of inefficiencies involved in the production of it. You're talking about shale gas, fracked gas, as many people say, look, natural gas is half the cost, or half the atmospheric cost is coal and oil. You're saying there are production costs that have to be factored in as well. So when you look at, for example, algae, What's the downside of algae? Is it simply difficult to scale up? Or what's the reason that algae isn't a widespread option?
Well, there are still technical barriers. For example, dewatering contains about 99% of water, and to dry the algae for extraction of those main components is expensive. Number two, algae, the wall, the cell wall, is as tough as lignocellulose. So to break that barrier, it takes a lot of effort. At the same time, this is where chemical engineers can contribute in terms of extraction, processing, fractionation. In other words, algae contains three main components, and plus the dissolution of the cell wall, there are multi-components to be separated into streams, each serving different purposes.
Okay, so if we are growing algae, then you said we have to dry it out before it becomes an energy source?
That's one thing. That's one thing. But the more recent trend has been to try to do the extraction of wet algae.
Okay.
And there are very interesting papers appearing in the literature. But to scale the process up takes some creativity.
Before I bring in Professor Shestopolov, do you want to offer any prediction? Because the media loves predictions, and we love short timelines. And I know that frustrates everyone in this room. But is algae going to be more scalable? Is it realistic to think it's more scalable in a decade, in a generation?
It is possible, but the research in this country, unfortunately, has lagged behind that going on in Europe and in China also, where applied research is more encouraged, more better funded.
All right, Professor Shestopolov, you have been waiting patiently. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to mention that algae is a relatively unique type of biomass. When we talk about biomass and conversion of biomass to fuels, we usually assume that we convert the tree materials that we have into the actual fuel, whereas with algae, it is possible to convert the actual microorganisms into more useful chemical forms, but it is also possible to genetically modify this organism to produce, so they would produce hydrogen, for example, or methane. And there is a lot of possibility in that, modifying algae to produce a certain type of chemical. But as Professor Shaw mentioned, there are multiple challenges in separating these chemicals from the actual aqueous environments of algae. So that's a challenging part.
Okay.
I just want to close this loop of the discussion about algae and cellulose. In general, that's the general perception in terms of the historical development. Bioethanol from corn is generation number one. And then lignocellulose as a source for bioethanol and other fuels and chemicals, that's generally considered number two, generation number two. And algae is upcoming, that's generation number three, where we are still looking forward to better government funding, especially for academic research.
Let me read a comment from Jake, who writes to the program, at current population growths, all the land devoted to agriculture will eventually have to be used to feed people. Isn't intentionally growing biomass for fuel an eventual dead end? I see the future only in recycling of our own wastes and an eventual replacement with solar or other pure renewables. Anyone want to jump in there?
Well, that's a very valid comment. Biofuels, they can be grown on land that we are not using for production of fuel. That's one of the advantages.
Production of food.
For the production of food, yes. That's one of the biggest advantages, I guess, of biomass, that we can grow it in almost any environment. Probably we won't be able to completely substitute our fuels with biomass, but biomass is unique from, for example, solar energy, is that it can produce the actual fuels and chemicals that we use right now, whereas if we want to convert solar energy into chemicals, that's going to be a much more difficult process.
That's exactly right. I think a few things. One is, certainly, a large portion of the United States is forested. If you look at New York State and compare it even to the 1700s, when we were all chopping down trees, I guess, back then to build buildings, we actually have more forests in New York State than we did in the late 1700s. Wherever there are forests, there is waste wood. The EPA requires whomever owns the land, whether it be public or private, to actually take the all the wood that drops off the tops of the trees out of the forest and off the forest floor.
And what happens with that now, Jack?
Oftentimes it's burned. It's typically pelletized, and a lot of that is burned in New York State, or it's even shipped across to Europe. It's a big booming business there. And we're absolutely convinced that there are better uses than just burning. So we can take waste wood, for example, extract the sugars from about 100 tons of wood. We can get 65 tons of sugar. And from that 65 tons of sugar, depending on the final product you're going to, if you're going to plastics or even certain food products like animal feed and food products, you can almost get a one-to-one ratio. So there's a tremendous amount of value, and if you just do the math on the economics, the value of those products is far, far greater than burning the wood pellets.
And I also want to repeat what Jack said early on and now. Biomass conversion is not only for fuels, but also for chemical feedstock. That supports our polymer industry, pharmaceutical, et cetera. And the chemical feedstock today is mostly derived from petroleum. So that's where the biomass conversion is going to play an increasing role. And we're not talking about replacing the relatively mature organic chemistry that can make everything. We are talking about making high-impact chemical feedstock that we enjoy in our daily life.
Mm-hmm. So whether bioenergy can be realistic source of energy, you know, can be based on a government survey of the supply of biomass. So based on USDA and DOE joint survey, they raised a so-called 1 billion ton region. And that means that agricultural waste and forest waste that Jack just mentioned accounts for about a billion ton of waste material that basically we throw away every year. So if we can convert this waste material all the way to cellulosic ethanol, it's going to meet about 30% of the transportation fuels in the United States. So 30% is a pretty significant chunk of the transportation need. And then we're thinking about for the last several decades, human beings have developed, devoted all the energy to engineer or breed the food crops. We never really breed the plant and crop for the purpose of energy generation. So let's say that we can, you know, devote our energy in the next 2-3 decades into engineering or into breeding plants for the energy purpose, and we can increase the productivity by a factor of 3 or 4. It means that we can replace all the transportation energy need 100%, and then we have a remaining bioenergies and biomass for plastic, for material, etc. And that so is can be a totally carbon neutral in this bioenergy business.
Our hour is flying by. I've got to get a 60-second break in, and more of your questions are going to be answered next as we talk about the future of energy on this monthly science roundtable with David Wu, Sha Chen, and Alex Shestopolov from the Department of Chemical Engineering at the University of Rochester, Jack Barron from Sweetwater Energy, a company based in Rochester that is aiming to produce renewable, and doing that, I should say aiming to, Jack will tell me they are producing renewable alternatives to petroleum. The future of energy, and your questions answered next on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, we sit down with a Palestinian doctor who lost 3 of his daughters to an Israeli missile strike in 2009 in his Gaza home. He's written a book called I Shall Not Hate, and he travels the world now with his message of trying to end the violence between Israelis and Palestinians. Dr. Izzeldin Abueleish, next hour, Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and if you want to call the program with questions or comments about the future of energy usage, it's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Plenty of you are finding me at Evan Dawson on Twitter as well. We'll get to your comments coming up. Briefly, Michelle Faust is my colleague in the WXXI newsroom. What's going on, Michelle?
Well, you guys are talking about innovation. And when we talk about innovation, I always want people to think about health. So we're doing a lot of stuff on our program, the Understanding the Affordable Care Act. You can see that on our website at WXXI.org/ACA. And we're taking questions, and we want to hear any kind of questions you have about health insurance, health in general, any kind of question that you have. You can submit that at ACAWXXI@WXXI.org and follow our hashtag ACAWXXI. Hoping to hear from you.
One more time, the website,
WXXI.org/ACA.
Thank you, Michelle. Appreciate that. Let me get to a listener comment named Anderson. Anderson writes, I'm a conservative who will say that Obama has one thing right. It's that a, and I've got a long comment here. Let me go ahead and try to edit you down, Anderson. Anderson is basically saying that he thinks the president's right when the president says one size does not fit all for energy. We need an all-of-the-above approach. While I'd like to see the Keystone Pipeline, Anderson says, I would also like to see a lot of the options being discussed on this program. And he says what offended him about corn-based ethanol was that the government was picking one big winner instead of seeing lots of winners and losers. Jack, it's an interesting comment, and I think he's saying he's right. The president has called for more of a all of the above when it comes to energy. Is that the future that, you know, if we guess what 50 years from now we will be consuming for transportation needs, it's going to be a wide variety as opposed to one main source?
Absolutely. It'll certainly be a wide variety. I think, and the previous caller talked about solar. It will be solar. It will be wind. It'll be geothermal. And to kind of the point that's been made today, we will be extracting carbon from biomass. And that's kind of great news because the world will survive without oil. Eventually, the world will run out of oil, whether it's 50 years or 100 years or 150 years from now, or the last barrel will be too expensive to extract. And we will still be able to have plastics and all the products we depend on every day that'll be coming from current carbon instead of 400 million-year-old carbon. And I think that's very, very exciting. So, but you raise a great question. What's the roadmap? How do we get there? What does the next 10, 20, 30 years look like? We're working with corn ethanol producers around the country because they are increasingly moving toward integrated biorefineries. That's what they're calling it. And even the folks at DuPont and Poet and Abengoa, who I mentioned earlier, they've got integrated biorefineries. The petroleum industry has been fantastic at kind of eking every ounce of value from a barrel of oil. They convert it into just an incredible number of chemicals, including the plastics we talked about, as well as petroleum, or as well as gasoline and transportation fuels. That's what you're beginning to see in the integrated biorefinery. So we make, for example, two different types of sugar from trees, from wood, from grasses, a six-carbon sugar that we all eat every day, like glucose, and a five-carbon sugar that you can get at Wegmans, believe it or not, in the form of zellies and mints and gum and so forth. And we make both those types of sugars. And from those, you can make these same plastics and all the other things just about that you can make from petroleum. So that really is the future. The future will be integrated biorefineries. It'll be a stronger agricultural society. You take Hilton, New York, for example. It's an ag community right near here. If you have biorefineries in Hilton, New York, and you have one nearby in Medina with Western New York Energy, their corn ethanol facility. But if you, based on cellulosic, where you're bringing in wood or creating purpose-grown energy crops, and to Jake's comment earlier, energy crops that can be grown on soil that's not suitable for growing food-based crops, that we can actually use sorghum and miscanthus and switchgrass, and those things will be able to create all these products like the plastic bottles we're drinking from.
Carrie wanted to know what the difference, she heard the usage of the terms biomass and biofuel. My understanding is that biomass is the material, biofuel is the energy that comes out of it. Is that the, Alex, you're nodding, is that right?
Well, essentially, biofuels are the same type of fuel that we already use from oil industry. It just defined as bio because it's produced from biomass. And biomass is something that we take from trees, from plants, and convert into biofuel or other chemicals. So that's
okay. So let's talk a little bit more about then what the current landscape is becoming. Again, we've talked about how 10 years ago I heard so much about algae. 10 years ago, I also heard a lot about switchgrass and cellulosic ethanol. And Jack had mentioned that to some degree, I don't know if I'm mischaracterizing, cellulosic rolled out a little bit slower than we thought?
A lot slower.
Okay, a lot slower. And what's the main reason for that it's been slower?
It turns out that it's very difficult to take trees or grass or biomass and convert that into sugar, which is really the essential first step, at least so far in terms of the technology. It turns out that if you use heat and chemicals, for example, to do that, you get a lot of nasty things along the way. They call them inhibitors. Maybe the best way to think about this technically is if you imagine how a cow actually chews up grass and creates sugar for its own body, that's effectively what this industry is trying to do at an industrial scale. So using a combination of mechanical means, like chewing in a cow, we grind things up, and then heat under extreme pressure, so you have very high heat, and then chemicals, so we use acids and so forth, and there are other folks who are doing it slightly differently. Again, it turns out, Evan, that that's very difficult to pull off, which is why, as we're into this now since 2006, we're one of the first companies that's been able to sign commercial contracts around the country, because we actually have a technology now that gets us all the way to a sugar that is highly fermentable and can be used, and it can be done economically, because, you know, this is a green revolution happening here, but it only matters if it's green in your wallet. It can't just be green for sustainability.
Well, it's got to be green in your wallet, and it's got to be authentically green in terms of the environment. I don't mean to dog corn-based ethanol too much, because, you know, it may be one component in many. We'll get back to your phone calls in a second. I see the phone ringing, but let me also say that corn-based ethanol, in many ways, turned out to have environmental costs to it associated with the land. And by some measurements, there is a notion that it is more burdensome than gasoline in terms of environmental costs. So Jack, before I kick it around the panel here, you've got to make sure that what you're doing, you talked about the, what was the term, the side product, the heat, the nasty things on the side?
Inhibitors.
Inhibitors. You've got to make sure that you are doing things as efficiently as possible, because what is ostensibly a green process might not be as green as it seems.
It's a great point. And in general, this is true in our case, and if you read about the literature out there on cellulosic, far, far less environmentally impacting. There's always some environmental impact when you set up a facility and you're creating heat. You've got just even the environmental impact around that alone. But from a water standpoint and an air standpoint, those are the primary things you look at. Are you polluting when you're creating these things? And we were permitted in Wisconsin recently for a facility, and Wisconsin is certainly very serious about the way they go through permitting, arguably even more serious than California, where we're working as well. And they loved our profile because we are so low in terms of the emissions we're creating from a water and from an air standpoint. So nothing's perfect, but cellulosic is definitely a major leap forward versus corn ethanol.
Before I get to Tom's call here, panel, can you jump in? David, go ahead.
I want to add something from the technical or academic type perspective. And then beside cows and lamb and goat that, you know, can live on grass, this is also an example of termite that actually live on eating wood. So technically, it is possible to really convert cellulose into sugar that can be fermented to ethanol of other type of biofuels. Now the cellulose is really designed in nature for structural purpose, so it's very difficult to break down. So wood would take, you know, years to really completely break down. And what we like to do is really to speed that up. And that has been difficult in terms of the crystalline structure, the hydrogen bond, we call hydrogen bond, that hold the cellulose chains together, as well as the lack of expertise. So as a nation became aware that we may need to use bioenergy to fight the climate change, we realized that there's a whole generation of scientists that has not been trained into looking at the bioenergy or biomass as a potential energy source. And so because of the relatively low gasoline price for the last decades, we don't really have scientists and engineers really trained to develop this technology. And it's a shame to say that cellulose is the most abundant organic biomass or material in the world. But our understanding of cellulose breaking down by microorganisms, by enzymes, is so limited that we have so little understanding of this really take place inside termite or in the rumen of the animal.
Is that changing? I mean, are we getting better?
I think that we are changing. We are training new graduate student, postdoc, scientists to be aware that this is a very important research area. And so I can see that with the technology development, now we are able to sequence, you know, DNA is very low cost, a very high speed. We are able to manipulate genetic makeup of the trees and grasses and microorganisms and change the enzyme to be more efficient, to be low cost, and work faster. I think that next decade or two will promise to be a revolutionary in terms of technology development in this particular area.
Well, let me get to the phones, and we've got a great panel talking about the future of biofuels on our monthly science roundtable. This is Tom in Rochester. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, this is a plant down. It's growing across the south. I guess it's growing so fast, I don't know what to do with it. It's called Cutskill.
How do you spell it, Tom? Tom, how do you spell that? The name of that plant?
I'm going to guess it's K-U-D-Z-O or something like that.
K-U-D-Z-O, Kudzo or Kudzko? Anybody
something
familiar?
Like that.
Sounds like a...
Kudzu?
Sounds like a form of grass.
It's growing all over the south. I don't know what to do with it. It's growing so fast.
And you're saying, again, if this is sort of an invasive species, is there... Tom, have you read any literature? Is there an application?
Oh, I heard it a couple of years ago, and every once in a while you hear about it. And some farm or something down there is growing so fast they can't cut it down fast enough to.
You know, it's funny he brings this up because there are a lot of species, invasive and otherwise, grasses in particular, that can be harvested, in fact, and have the sugar be converted into sugar, exactly what we're talking about here. Ron Boylott, who's our chief deployment officer, he recently actually began experimenting with our science group on cattails, of all things. So, I mean, you can actually even extract biomass from cattails.
Well, I'm reading that it must be kudzu, K-U-D-Z-U, and it was a couple of years ago now that it was seen as, it's a giant reed, kind of. It's a hard, hard-cased kind of plant. And it was viewed as at least as an idea that I'm looking at the Biofuel Center of North Carolina wanted to know if kudzu had a future as a biofuel. I haven't heard anything since a couple of years ago. Anybody in this room? No?
No.
Okay. Online, another listener wants to know about camelina, which I've not heard of. It's an you're nodding over there, Jack. Is that an oil seed?
It is. In fact, it's an oil seed. So camelina... I'd say over the last 7 years, we've experimented with maybe 70 different forms of feedstock and to see how much sugar we could extract. Camelina is not high on our list. Really, going back to some of the earlier questions, availability and cost are kind of the key factors for us, so which is why waste wood is extremely attractive. Miscanthus and switchgrass, extremely attractive. But we're all the way, you know, food processing waste is actually a big deal too. A lot of that times that gets landfilled, and so if it's got cellulose, like for example, you know, the skins of oranges, literally, or orange peels, or other, we're actually working with a lot of different food waste today, even locally here in Greater Rochester, and we can extract the cellulose from that, and from the cellulose we can actually turn that into sugar and then turn it into chemicals and household things.
Can I?
Yeah, please do.
I think that in this country, it's going to be the biomass source is going to be depending on the climate, location, and the soil. So we're not talking about one type of biomass. We're talking about many different types of biomass. And also a biorefinery has to be located in where the biomass is located. So we're talking about hundreds of biorefinery the manufacturers around the country, scattered around hundreds of them, that are close to where the biomass is. And so it has to be within like 50 miles to 100 miles of radius, so the biomass material can be transported to the manufacturer for making ethanol.
Number of listeners have asked about the Keystone Pipeline. Again, that's not the focus of this hour. Shaw Chen, you weighed in on the notion of fracking as something that you are right. You offered some relief on New York's decision. So when we talk about energy, are we distracted if we build Keystone, for example? Does that further distract us from simply moving to other sources, or is that part of the solution?
Well, the fracking and the shale oil and gas certainly has put a dent on the enthusiasm, as if I can use the word, mm-hmm. on renewables, including biomass, but. Fracking has its cost for us to pay, as you rightly pointed out. That is, there are environmental footprints. The leakage of methane into the atmosphere will cost more than the carbon dioxide as the greenhouse emission. At the same time, fracking involves, if I can use the word, that is environmental disfigurement, and the pumping of a lot of water in which all sorts of chemicals are mixed to enable breaking down the concrete, basically, down there. Therefore, there's a cost issue, especially the environmental issue. And methane, along with oil, they are part of the fossil fuels that caused the greenhouse emission, the climate change in the first place. And there is, as far as the conversion to useful chemical feedstock is concerned, methane offers very limited compared to biomass. I also want to follow up with Professor Wu or David Wu's comment. That is, indeed, you pointed out to Evan that lignocellulosic ethanol has fallen behind schedule quite a bit. It's out in the public domain. But that's where genetic engineering, biotechnology, and biochemical engineering will help us a great deal. And I came across some papers recently, a very interesting work, that is, genetic engineer modification could give us cellulosic biomass source that are more readily disposable, more
combustible.
Combustible. No, I should say
degradable.
Degradable. Yeah. Degradable. That's right. To assist in the development process. And okay. The other thing is that, as mature as fermentation, I'm not an expert in that area, but there's some very interesting work. Yeast is commonly used to ferment carbohydrate into alcohol, ethanol. But unfortunately, yeast is just like human beings, they cannot work effectively when they are intoxicated. And they are intoxicated by the alcohol, especially ethanol, they are meant to produce as part of the bioethanol production. And the way to overcome the difficulty, again, illustrate how genetic engineering could be very useful to overcome the fundamental limitations, to enhance the productivity of that fermentation process.
Shaw is exactly right. We're working with the University of Rochester, RIT, MIT, Oak Ridge National Labs, folks who actually spun a company out of Purdue, and there's a tremendous amount of genetic engineering that's going on right now that is advancing this field, and it's moving much more quickly, finally. But unfortunately, it took about a decade for it to kind of really get started. So I think what the government did right, the federal government did, was really under President Bush, and along with the Pelosi Congress. So it was actually bipartisan back in 06 and 07 when they did this. They really effectively launched the industry, this whole cellulosic industry, which is just now finally poised to take off.
Let me get to the phones again, and this is Robert in Fairport. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, interesting discussion. The problem in this area, though, is that most of these technologies are just not scalable. What my experience has been is that you're seeing companies that are experimenting with this stuff, fuels based on biomass, and they've actually gone into the food ingredient business and the food flavor business because the scale is much less. The capital requirements are a lot less, too, and a lot of companies just haven't been able to make a go of it. One company in particular that I'm familiar with that's done this is a company called Blue Marble Biomaterials. I think they're out of Montana, actually. That's been really the bane of this market is nobody can make a go of it because the capital requirements are just enormous.
Thanks for the call. Go ahead, panel. Yeah, Sean?
Right. Scale-up is part of the engineering practice that we do in our discipline. And I'll give you an example of how scale-up is important to bring down the cost. The more need, the more production we can afford, the lower the unit price will be. And as you know, Solarzyme has a big contract with about 17 airlines, companies in this country. The project, the agreement is meant to produce biofuels from algae. And we don't know how long that will go, but it's certainly was in the press release some time ago.
Solarzyme is an excellent example, a company called Genomatica. They're making about 20 million pounds of product now. So Robert's right, it's been a big challenge. But to Shah's point, really engineering is beginning to address the challenge.
As Trent is a biochemical engineer, I like to bring up this story about penicillin. When penicillin was first discovered by Alexander Fleming, the organism, the fungus, could only produce like 2 units per mil, per milliliter of penicillin. So the first clinical trial was carried out on an infant because there was not enough material for the clinical trial. And the first dose of penicillin actually worked to eliminate the fever of the infant, but then it ran out of material, so the infant eventually died. But so we're talking about at that moment, say, if we're going to develop it, penicillin for treating infection, it was like a dream impossible, mission impossible. But the work between chemical engineers and biologists and the government has resulted into penicillin now is so inexpensive that it could not even be produced economically in the United States. So we are, you know, kind of sourcing out the penicillin production to other countries. And so looking at the bioenergy, it seemed to be, you know, so challenging at this moment. But if we look, you know, into the story of penicillin, maybe, you know, there's a hope that by putting in enough resources, like we did with penicillin story, eventually it will become possible.
Well, let me ask Professor Shestopalov one more quick question before we start to wrap up here. And I don't know if I'm thinking in a sort of a false choice kind of a situation, but I look at California has big water issues. We get a lot of our food from California. There are all kinds of questions about our choices when it comes to water, just to produce almonds, for example, or some of the vegetables that we think we're entitled to year-round now. Everything I'm hearing about when it comes to energy requires a lot of water. I worked in West Virginia. I saw the coal industry. The water that is used just to wash the coal becomes slurry, which looks like lakes from the air. Is there any alternative energy form that is not requiring a lot of water, or is at least giving us more of a kind of a diversified option?
Well, solar energy it doesn't really require any water.
Outside of to produce electricity. I'm more thinking about biomass. I'm more thinking about biomasses.
But with biomasses, I think depending on the type of grass that is used to produce biomass, they might require much less oil than food crops. And you know, biomass crops, they can be grown in areas where, you know, it's impossible to grow any food crops at all. So I don't know if water consumption is going to be a huge problem in biomass refinery to biofuels, but I don't think it's maybe the major problem right now.
Okay.
Yeah, generally not. I mean, trees are about 50% water, 50% moisture. So in a lot of ways, we actually generate water with our process right now, and we have to make sure it's clean when we're done using it. But that's the larger issue. But if you fly across Canada and look down, you'll see an outrageous amount of biomass.
And Professor Chen, what do you want our listeners to take from this hour? Is it, you know, we've had a lot of wisdom in this room, and you can never solve the world's problems in an hour. What do you want our listeners to take with them?
Right. Whatever new ventures we enter into, there will be challenges, and that's why we are here, academic researchers, educators, and with industrial partnership and government support, eventually, we're talking about the wealthiest country in the world, and we should continue to be the leader in a venture that has a long-term prospect.
Professor Shestopalov, what do you want our listeners to take away here?
Well, I agree. I agree with Professor Shaw that there are challenges with biomass, but certainly we can solve them in the future. There are no terminal challenges that can preclude us from using biomass to produce fuels, to produce other chemicals that we're already using right now, and maybe even use them to produce new materials.
And I remember what Professor Wu said earlier this hour, which was that, unfortunately, this is not a time where we simply have to wait until a crisis to innovate our way out of it. Some can argue that the crisis is unfolding before us, but I think the point was well made by Professor Wu as well. And Jack Barron from Sweetwater Energy, we'd love to have all of you back. I mean, frankly, this conversation is kind of too big to fit into an hour, but I hope we've tried to provide a framework. So thank you for taking the time, Jack.
Thank you.
Professor Wu, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Professor Chen, Professor Shestopolov, thank you so much for taking the time.
My pleasure.
A short break, and we're going to come back. We're going to meet a Palestinian doctor who lost three daughters to Israeli shelling in 2009. His message is, I shall not hate. He's in studio next.